Chapter 42. When I was discharged from hospital, I expected to be posted straight overseas, and I wondered if I would be able to catch up with my old flight and my friends. However, I learned with surprise that I had to go to a convalescent home for a fortnight before any further action could be taken. This was in Puddleston, near Leominster, a lovely mansion house in acres of beautiful gardens. It was presided over by a delightful old matron with whom we fortunate airmen played sedate games of croquet or walked in the cool woods. It was easy to imagine that there was no such thing as a war. 2 weeks of this treatment left me feeling revitalized. It wouldn't be long, I felt, before I was back on the job. From Puddleston, it was back to Manchester, and Heaton Park again. And this time it was strange to think that in all the great sprawl of huts and the crowding thousands of men in blue, there wasn't a soul who knew me. Except, of course, the wing commander, who had sent me to hospital in the first place. I had an interview with him on my arrival, and he came straight to the point. "Harriet," he said, "I'm afraid you can't fly anymore." "But I've had the operation. I'm a lot better." "I know that, but you can no longer be classed as 100% fit. You have been officially downgraded, and I'm sure you realize that pilots have to be grade one." "Yes, of course." He glanced at the file in his hand. "I see you are a veterinary surgeon. This poses a problem. Normally, when an aircrew man is grounded, he remusters on the ground staff, but yours is a reserved occupation. You really can't serve in any capacity but aircrew." Yes. We'll have to see." It was all very impersonal and businesslike. Those few words coming from a man like him left no room for argument. And they obliterated at a stroke every picture I had ever had of my future in the RAF. I was fairly certain that if my flying days were over, I would be discharged from the service. And as I left the wing commander's office and walked slowly back to my hut at the other end of the park, I pondered on my contribution to the war effort. I hadn't fired a shot in anger. I had peeled mountains of potatoes, washed countless dishes, shoveled coke, mucked out pigs, marched for miles, drilled interminably, finally and magically learnt to fly, and now it was all for nothing. I passed the big dining hall, and the RAF march blared out at me from the loudspeakers. The familiar sound reminded me of so many experiences, so many friends, and suddenly I felt intensely lonely and cut off. It was a new sensation for me, and there, in those unlikely surroundings, I began to think of old Mr. Potts from my veterinary days. He must have felt like that.
"How are you, Mr. Harriet?"
Ordinary words, but the eagerness, almost desperation, in the old man's voice made them urgent and meaningful. I saw him nearly every day. In my unpredictable life, it was difficult to do anything regularly, but I did like a stroll by the river before lunch, and so did my beagle Sam. That was when we met Mr. Potts and Nip, his elderly sheepdog. They seemed to have the same habits as we did. His house backed onto the riverside fields, and he spent a lot of time just walking around with his dog. Many retired farmers kept a bit of land and a few stock to occupy their minds and ease the transition from their arduous existence to day-long leisure. But Mr. Potts had bought a little bungalow with a scrap of garden, and it was obvious that time dragged. Probably his health had dictated this. As he faced me, he leant on his stick, and his bluish cheeks rose and fell with his breathing. He was a heart case if ever I saw one.
"Well, I'm fine, Mr. Potts," I replied. "And how are things with you?"
"Nobbut middling, lad. I soon get short of wind."
He coughed a couple of times, then asked the inevitable question.
"And what have you been doing this morning?"
That was when his eyes grew intent and wide. He really wanted to know. I thought for a moment.
"Well now, let's see." I always tried to give him a detailed answer because I knew it meant a lot to him and brought back the life he missed so much. "I've done a couple of cleansings, seen a lame bullock, treated 2 cows with mastitis and another with milk fever."
He nodded eagerly at every word.
"By God," he exclaimed. It's a beggar, that milk fever.
When I were a lad, good cows used to die like flies with it. All us good milkers, after their third or fourth calf, couldn't get to their feet, and we used to dose them with all sorts. But they died, every one of them. Yes, I said, it must have been heartbreaking in those days. But then, he smiled delightedly, digging a forefinger into my chest. Then we started blowing up their udders with a bicycle pump. And you know, they jumped up and walked away. Like magic, it were. His eyes sparkled at the memory. I know, Mr. Potts, I've blown up a few myself, only I didn't use a bicycle pump. I had a special little inflation apparatus. That black box with its shining cylinders and filter is now in my personal museum, and it is the best place for it. It had got me out of some difficult situations, but in the background there had always been the gnawing dread of transmitting tuberculosis. I had heard of it happening, and was glad that calcium borogluconate had arrived.